mask the fact that I believed a new day was dawning. I said, if the government reaction is to crush by naked force our non-violent struggle, we will have to reconsider our tactics. In my mind, we are closing a chapter on this question of a non-violent policy. It was a grave declaration, and I knew it. I was criticized by our executive for making that remark before it was discussed by the organization, but sometimes one must go public with an idea to push a reluctant organization in the direction you want it to go. The debate on the use of violence had been going on among us since early 1960. I had first discussed the armed struggle as far back as 1952 with Walter. Now I again conferred with him, and we agreed that the organization had to set out on a new course. The Communist Party had secretly reconstituted itself underground and was now considering forming its own military wing. We decided that I should raise the issue of the armed struggle within the working committee, and I did so in a meeting in June of 1961. I had barely commenced my proposal when Moses Kotane, the secretary of the Communist Party and one of the most powerful figures in the ANC executive, staged a counterassault, accusing me of not having thought out the proposal carefully enough. He said that I had been outmaneuvered and paralyzed by the government's actions, and now, in desperation, I was resorting to revolutionary language. "There is still room," he stressed, "for the old methods if we are imaginative and determined enough. If we embark on the course Mandela is suggesting, we will be exposing innocent people to massacres by the enemy." Moses spoke persuasively, and I could see that he had defeated my proposal. Even Walter did not speak on my behalf, and I backed down. Afterward, I spoke with Walter and voiced my frustration, chiding him for not coming to my aid. He laughed and said it would have been as foolish as attempting to fight a pride of angry lions. Walter is a diplomat and extremely resourceful. "Let me arrange for Moses to come and see you privately," he said, "and you can make your case that way." I was underground, but Walter managed to put the two of us together in a house in the township, and we spent the whole day talking. I was candid and explained why I believed we had no choice but to turn to violence. I used an old African expression, "The attacks of the wild beast cannot be averted with only bare hands." Moses was an old-line communist, and I told him that his opposition was like the Communist Party in Cuba under Batista. The party had insisted that the appropriate conditions had not yet arrived, and waited because they were simply following the textbook definitions of Lenin and Stalin. Castro did not wait. He acted, and he triumphed. If you wait for textbook conditions, they will never occur. I told Moses point blank that his mind was stuck in the old mold of the ANC's being a legal organization. People were already forming military units on their own, and the only organization that had the muscle to lead them was the ANC. We have always maintained that the people were ahead of us, and now they were. We talked the entire day, and at the end, Moses said to me, "Nelson, I will not promise you anything, but raise the issue again in committee, and we will see what happens." A meeting was scheduled in a week's time, and once again, I raised the issue. This time, Moses was silent, and the general consensus of the meeting was that I should make the proposal to the National Executive Committee in Durban. Walter simply smiled. The executive meeting in Durban, like all ANC meetings at the time, was held in secret and at night in order to avoid the police. I suspected I would encounter difficulties because Chief Lituli was to be in attendance, and I knew of his moral commitment to nonviolence. I was also wary because of the timing. I was raising the issue of violence so soon after the treason trial, where we had contended that for the ANC, nonviolence was an inviolate principle, not a tactic to be changed as conditions warranted. I myself believed precisely the opposite, that nonviolence was a tactic that should be abandoned when it no longer worked. At the meeting, I argued that the state had given us no alternative to violence. I said it was wrong and immoral to subject our people to armed attacks by the state without offering them some kind of alternative. I mentioned again that people on their own had taken up arms. Violence would begin whether we initiated it or not. Would it not be better to guide this violence ourselves, according to principles where we save lives by attacking symbols of oppression and not people? If we did not take the lead now, I said, we would soon be latecomers and followers to a movement we did not control. The chief initially resisted my arguments. For him, nonviolence was not simply a tactic. But we worked on him the whole night, and I think that in his heart he realized that we were right. He ultimately agreed that a military campaign was inevitable. When someone later insinuated that perhaps the chief was not prepared for such a course, he retorted, "If anyone thinks I'm a pacifist, let him try to take my chickens, and he will know how wrong he is." The National Executive formally endorsed the preliminary decision of the Working Committee. The chief and others suggested that we should treat this new resolution as if the ANC had not discussed it. He did not want to jeopardize the legality of our unbanned allies. His idea was that a military movement should be a separate and independent organ, linked to the ANC and under the overall control of the ANC, but fundamentally autonomous. There would be two separate streams of the struggle. We readily accepted the chief's suggestion. The chief and others warned against this new phase becoming an excuse for neglecting the essential tasks of organization and the traditional methods of struggle. That, too, would be self-defeating, because the armed struggle, at least in the beginning, would not be the centerpiece of the movement. The following night, a meeting of the joint executives was scheduled in Durban. This would include the Indian Congress, the Colored People's Congress, the South African Congress of Trade Unions, and the Congress of Democrats. Although these other groups customarily accepted ANC decisions, I knew that some of my Indian colleagues would strenuously oppose the move toward violence. The meeting had an inauspicious beginning. Chief Lutuli, who was presiding, announced that even though the ANC had endorsed a decision on violence, "It is a matter of such gravity I would like my colleagues here tonight to consider the issue afresh." It was apparent that the chief was not fully reconciled to our new course. We began our session at 8 p.m., and it was tumultuous. I made the identical arguments that I had been making all along, and many people expressed reservations. Yusuf Kachalia and Dr. Naker pleaded with us not to embark on this course, arguing that the state would slaughter the whole liberation movement. J.N. Singh, an effective debater, uttered words that night which still echo in my head. "Nonviolence has not failed us," he said. "We have failed nonviolence." I countered by saying that in fact nonviolence had failed us, for it had done nothing to stem the violence of the state nor change the heart of our oppressors. We argued the entire night, and in the early hours of the morning I began to feel we were making progress. Many of the Indian leaders were now speaking in a sorrowful tone about the end of nonviolence. But then suddenly M.D. Naidu, a member of the South African Indian Congress, burst forth and said to his Indian colleagues, "Ah, you are afraid of going to jail, that is all." His comment caused pandemonium in the meeting. When you question a man's integrity, you can expect a fight. The entire debate went back to square one. But toward dawn, there was a resolution. The Congresses authorized me to go ahead and form a new military organization, separate from the ANC. The policy of the ANC would still be that of nonviolence. I was authorized to join with whomever I wanted or needed to create this organization, and would not be subject to the direct control of the mother organization. This was a fateful step. For 50 years, the ANC had treated nonviolence as a core principle, beyond question or debate. Henceforth, the ANC would be a different kind of organization. we were embarking on a new and more dangerous path, a path of organized violence, the results of which we did not and could not know. Chapter 42. I, who had never been a soldier, who had never fought in battle, who had never fired a gun at an enemy, had been given the task of starting an army. It would be a daunting task for a veteran general, much less a military novice. The name of this new organization was Mkhonto Wisizwe, the Spear of the Nation, or MK for short. The symbol of the spear was chosen because with this simple weapon, Africans had resisted the incursions of whites for centuries. Although the executive of the ANC did not allow white members, MK was not thus constrained. I immediately recruited Joe Slovo, and along with Walter Sisulu, we formed the High Command, with myself as chairman. Through Joe, I enlisted the efforts of white Communist Party members who had resolved on a course of violence and had already executed acts of sabotage, like cutting government telephone and communication lines. We recruited Jack Hodgson, who had fought in World War II and was a member of the Springbok Legion, and Rusty Bernstein, both party members. Jack became our first demolitions expert. Our mandate was to wage acts of violence against the state. Precisely what form those acts would take was yet to be decided. Our intention was to begin with what was least violent to individuals, but most damaging to the state. I began the only way I knew how, by reading and talking to experts. What I wanted to find out were the fundamental principles for starting a revolution. I discovered that there was a great deal of writing on this very subject, and I made my way through the available literature on armed warfare, and in particular, guerrilla warfare. I wanted to know what circumstances were appropriate for a guerrilla war, how one created, trained, and maintained a guerrilla force, how it should be armed, where it gets its supplies, all basic and fundamental questions. Any and every source was of interest to me. I read the report of Blas Roca, the General Secretary of the Communist Party of Cuba, about their years as an illegal organization during the Batista regime. In Commando, by Dennis Reitz, I read of the unconventional guerrilla tactics of the Boer generals during the Anglo-Boer War. I read works by and about Che Guevara, Mao Zedong, Fidel Castro. In Edgar Snow's brilliant Red Star Over China, I saw that it was Mao's determination and non-traditional thinking that led him to victory. I read The Revolt by Menachem Begin and was encouraged by the fact that the Israeli leader had led a guerrilla force in a country with neither mountains nor forests, a situation similar to our own. I was eager to know more about the armed struggle of the people of Ethiopia against Mussolini and of the guerrilla armies of Kenya, Algeria, and the Cameroons. I went into the South African past. I studied our history both before and after the white man. I probed the wars of African against African, of African against white, of white against white. I made a survey of the country's chief industrial areas, the nation's transportation system, its communication network. I accumulated detailed maps and systematically analyzed the terrain of different regions of the country. On June 26, 1961, our Freedom Day, I released a letter to South African newspapers from underground, which commended the people for their courage during the recent stay-at-home, once more calling for a national constitutional convention. I again proclaimed that a countrywide campaign of non-cooperation would be launched if the state failed to hold such a convention. My letter read, in part, "I am informed that a warrant for my arrest has been issued and that the police are looking for me. The National Action Council has given full and serious consideration to this question, and they have advised me not to surrender myself. I have accepted this advice and will not give myself up to a government I do not recognize. any serious politician will realize that under present-day conditions in the country, to seek for cheap martyrdom by handing myself to the police is naive and criminal. I have chosen this course, which is more difficult and which entails more risk and hardship than sitting in jail. I have had to separate myself from my dear wife and children, from my mother and sisters to live as an outlaw in my own land. I have had to close my business, to abandon my profession and live in poverty, as many of my people are doing. I shall fight the government side by side with you, inch by inch and mile by mile, until victory is won. What are you going to do? Will you come along with us? Or are you going to cooperate with the government in its efforts to suppress the claims and aspirations of your own people? Are you going to remain silent and neutral in a matter of life and death to my people, to our people? For my own part, I have made my choice. I will not leave South Africa, nor will I surrender. Only through hardship, sacrifice, and militant action can freedom be won. The struggle is my life. I will continue fighting for freedom until the end of my days. Chapter 43. During those first few months underground, I lived for a few weeks with a family on Market Street, after which I shared a one-room ground-floor bachelor flat with Wolfie Kodesh in Berea, a quiet white suburb a short distance north of downtown. Wolfie was a member of the Congress of Democrats, a reporter for New Age, and had fought in North Africa and Italy during World War II. His knowledge of warfare and his first-hand battle experience were extremely helpful to me. At his suggestion, I read the Prussian general Karl von Clausewitz's classic work, On War. Clausewitz's central thesis, that war was a continuation of diplomacy by other means, dovetailed with my own instincts. I relied on Wolfie to procure reading material for me, and I fear that I took over his life, infringing on both his work and pleasure. But he was such an amiable, modest fellow that he never complained. I spent nearly 2 months in his flat, sleeping on a campaign stretcher, staying inside during the day with the blinds drawn, reading and planning, leaving only for meetings or organizing sessions at night. I annoyed Wolfie every morning, for I would wake up at 5, change into my sweat clothes, and run in place for more than an hour. Wolfie eventually surrendered to my regimen and began working out with me in the morning before he left for town. MK was then practicing setting off explosions. One night, I accompanied Wolfie to an old brickworks on the outskirts of town for a demonstration. It was a security risk, but I wanted to attend MK's first test of an explosive device. Explosions were common at the brickworks, for companies would use dynamite to loosen the clay before the great machines scooped it up to make bricks. Jack Hodgson had brought along a paraffin tin filled with nitroglycerin. He had created a timing device that used the inside of a ballpoint pen. It was dark, and we had only a small light, and we stood to the side as Jack worked. When it was ready, we stood back and counted down to 30 seconds. There was a great roar and much displaced earth. The explosion had been a success, and we all quickly returned to our cars and went off in different directions. I felt safe in Berea. I did not go outside, and because it was a white area, the police would probably not think to look for me there. While I was reading in the flat during the day, I would often place a pint of milk on the windowsill to allow it to ferment. I am very fond of this sour milk, which is known as amasi among the Xhosa people and is greatly prized as a healthy and nourishing food. It is very simple to make and merely involves letting the milk stand in the open air and curdle. It then becomes thick and sour, rather like yogurt. I even prevailed upon Wolfie to try it, but he grimaced when he tasted it. One evening after Wolfie had returned, we were chatting in the flat when I overheard a conversation going on near the window. I could hear two young black men speaking in Zulu, but I could not see them, as the curtains were drawn. I motioned Wolfie to be quiet. "What is our milk doing on that window ledge?" one of the fellows said. "What are you talking about?" replied the other fellow. "The sour milk, Amasi, on the window ledge," he said. "What is it doing there?" Then there was silence. The sharp-eyed fellow was suggesting that only a black man would place milk on the ledge like that, and what was a black man doing living in a white area? I realized then that I needed to move on. I left for a different hideout the next night. I stayed at a doctor's house in Johannesburg, sleeping in the servants' quarters at night and working in the doctor's study during the day. Whenever anyone came to the house during the day, I would dash out to the backyard and pretend to be the gardener. I then spent about a fortnight on a sugar plantation in Natal, living with a group of African laborers and their families in a small community called Tongat, just up the coast from Durban. I lived in a hostel and posed as an agricultural demonstrator who had come at the behest of the government to evaluate the land. I had been equipped by the organization with a demonstrator's tools, and I spent part of each day testing the soil and performing experiments. I little understood what I was doing, and I do not think I fooled the people of Tongat. But these men and women, who were mostly farm workers, had a natural kind of discretion and did not question my identity, even when they began seeing people arriving at night in cars, some of them well-known local politicians. Often I was at meetings all night and would sleep all day. Not the normal schedule of an agricultural demonstrator. But even though I was involved in other matters, I felt a closeness with that community. I would attend services on Sunday, and I enjoyed the old-fashioned, Bible-thumping style of these Zionist Christian ministers. Shortly before I was planning to leave, I thanked one elderly fellow for having looked after me. He said, "You are, of course, welcome. But Kwedene, young man, please tell us, what does Chief Lituli want?" I was taken aback, but I quickly responded, "Well, it would be better to ask him yourself, and I cannot speak for him. But as I understand it, he wants our land returned. He wants our kings to have their power back, and he wants us to be able to determine our own future and run our own lives as we see fit."
"And how is he going to do that if he does not have an army?" the old man said. I wanted very much to tell the old man that I was busy attempting to form that army, but I could not. While I was encouraged by the old man's sentiments, I was nervous that others had discovered my mission as well. Again, I had stayed too long in one place, and the following night I left as quietly as I had arrived.
Chapter 44. My next address was more of a sanctuary than a hideout. Lily's Leaf Farm, located in Rivonia, a bucolic northern suburb of Johannesburg, and I moved there in October. In those days, Rivonia consisted mainly of farms and small holdings. The farmhouse and property had been purchased by the movement for the purpose of having a safe house for those underground. It was an old house that needed work, and no one lived there. I moved in under the pretext that I was the houseboy or caretaker who would look after the place until my master took possession. I had taken the alias David Motsamai, the name of one of my former clients. At the farm, I wore the simple blue overalls that were the uniform of the black male servant. During the day, the place was busy with workers, builders, and painters who were repairing the main house and extending the outbuildings. We wanted to have a number of small rooms added to the house so more people could stay. The workers were all Africans from Alexandra Township, and they called me waiter or boy. They never bothered to ask my name. I prepared breakfast for them and made them tea in the late morning and afternoon. They also sent me on errands about the farm, or ordered me to sweep the floor or pick up trash. One afternoon, I informed them that I had prepared tea in the kitchen. They came in and I passed around a tray with cups, tea, milk, and sugar. Each man took a cup and helped himself.
As I was carrying the tray, I came to one fellow who was in the middle of telling a story. He took a cup of tea, but he was concentrating more on his story than on me, and he simply held his teaspoon in the air while he was talking, using it to gesture and tell his tale rather than help himself to some sugar. I stood there for what seemed like several minutes, and finally, in mild exasperation, I started to move away. At that point, he noticed me and said sharply, "Waiter, come back here. I didn't say you could leave." Many people have painted an idealistic picture of the egalitarian nature of African society. And while in general I agree with this portrait, the fact is that Africans do not always treat each other as equals. Industrialization has played a large role in introducing the urban African to the perceptions of status common to white society. To those men, I was an inferior, a servant, a person without a trade, and therefore to be treated with disdain. I played the role so well that none of them suspected I was anything other than what I seemed. Every day at sunset, the workers would return to their homes, and I would be alone until the next morning. I relished these hours of quiet, but on most evenings I would leave the property to attend meetings, returning in the middle of the night. I often felt uneasy coming back at such hours to a place I did not know well and where I was living illegally under an assumed name. I recall being frightened one night when I thought I saw someone lurking in the bushes. Although I investigated, I found nothing. An underground freedom fighter sleeps very lightly. After a number of weeks, I was joined at the farm by Raymond Mhlaba, who had journeyed up from Port Elizabeth. Ray was a staunch trade unionist, a member of the Cape Executive and the Communist Party, and the first ANC leader to be arrested in the Defiance campaign. He had been chosen by the ANC to be one of the first recruits for Umkhonto Wesizwe. He had come to prepare for his departure, with three others, for military training in the People's Republic of China. We had renewed the contacts that Walter had made back in 1952. Ray stayed with me for a fortnight and provided me with a clearer picture of the problems the ANC was having in the Eastern Cape. I also enlisted his assistance in writing the MK Constitution. We were joined by Joe Slovo as well as Rusty Bernstein, who both had hands in drafting it. After Raymond left, I was joined for a brief time by Michael Harmel, a key figure in the underground Communist Party, a founding member of the Congress of Democrats, and an editor of the magazine Liberation. Michael was a brilliant theorist and was working on policy matters for the Communist Party and needed a quiet and safe place to work on this full time. During the day, I kept my distance from Michael, as it would have seemed exceedingly curious if a white professional man and an African houseboy were having regular conversations. But at night, after the workers left, we had long conversations about the relationship between the Communist Party and the ANC. One night, I returned to the farm late after a meeting. When I was there alone, I made sure that all the gates were locked and the lights were out. I took quite a few precautions, because a black man driving a car into a small holding in Rivonia in the middle of the night would attract unwanted questions. But I saw that the house lights were on, and as I approached the house, I heard a radio blaring. The front door was open, and I walked in and found Michael in bed, fast asleep. I was furious at this breach of security, and I woke him up and said, "Man, how can you leave the lights on and the radio playing?" He was groggy but angry. "Nell, must you disturb my sleep? Can't this wait until tomorrow?" I said it couldn't. It was a matter of security, and I reprimanded him for his lax conduct. Soon after this, Arthur Goldreich and his family moved into the main house as official tenants, and I took over the newly built domestic workers' cottage. Arthur's presence provided a safe cover for all activities. Arthur was an artist and designer by profession, a member of the Congress of Democrats, and one of the first members of MK. His politics were unknown to the police, and he had never before been questioned or raided. In the 1940s, Arthur had fought with the Palmach, the military wing of the Jewish National Movement, in Palestine. He was knowledgeable about guerrilla warfare and helped fill many gaps in my knowledge. Arthur was a flamboyant person, and he gave the farm a buoyant atmosphere. The final addition to the regular group at the farm was Mr. Jellyman, an amiable white pensioner and old friend of the movement who became the farm foreman. Mr. Jellyman brought in several young workers from Sekukunuland, and the place soon appeared to be like any other smallholding in the country. Jellyman was not a member of the ANC, but he was loyal, discreet, and hard-working. I used to prepare breakfast for him as well as supper, and he was unfailingly gracious. Much later, Jellyman risked his own life and livelihood in a courageous attempt to help me. The loveliest times at the farm were when I was visited by my wife and family. Once the Goldreichs were in residence, Winnie would visit me on weekends. We were careful about her movements, and she would be picked up by one driver, dropped off at another place, and then picked up by a second driver before finally being delivered to the farm. Later, she would drive herself and the children, taking the most circuitous route possible. The police were not yet following her every move. On these weekends, time would sometimes seem to stop as we pretended that these stolen moments together were the rule, not the exception of our lives. Ironically, we had more privacy at Lily's Leaf than we ever had at home. The children could run about and play, and we were secure, however briefly, in this idyllic bubble. Wendy brought me an old air rifle that I had in Orlando, and Arthur and I would use it for target practice or hunting doves on the farm. One day I was on the front lawn of the property and aimed the gun at a sparrow perched high in a tree. Hazel Goldreich, Arthur's wife, was watching me and jokingly remarked that I would never hit my target. But she had hardly finished the sentence when the sparrow fell to the ground. I turned to her and was about to boast when the Goldreich's son, Paul, then about 5 years old, turned to me with tears in his eyes and said, "David, why did you kill that bird? Its mother will be sad." My mood immediately shifted from one of pride to shame. I felt that this small boy had far more humanity than I did. It was an odd sensation for a man who was the leader of a nascent guerrilla army. Chapter 45. In planning the direction and form that MK would take, we considered four types of violent activities: sabotage, guerrilla warfare, terrorism, and open revolution. For a small and fledgling army, open revolution was inconceivable. Terrorism inevitably reflected poorly on those who used it, undermining any public support it might otherwise garner. Guerrilla warfare was a possibility, but since the ANC had been reluctant to embrace violence at all, it made sense to start with the form of violence that inflicted the least harm against individuals, sabotage. Because it did not involve loss of life, it offered the best hope for reconciliation among the races afterward. We did not want to start a blood feud between white and black. Animosity between Afrikaner and Englishmen was still sharp 50 years after the Anglo-Boer War. What would race relations be like between white and black if we provoked a civil war? Sabotage had the added virtue of requiring the least manpower. Our strategy was to make selective forays against military installations, power plants, telephone lines, and transportation links, targets that would not only hamper the military effectiveness of the state, but frighten National Party supporters, scare away foreign capital, and weaken the economy. This, we hoped, would bring the government to the bargaining table. Strict instructions were given to members of MK that we would countenance no loss of life. But if sabotage did not produce the results we wanted, we were prepared to move on to the next stage, guerrilla warfare and terrorism. The structure of MK mirrored that of the parent organization. The National High Command was at the top, Below it were regional commands in each of the provinces, and below that there were local commands and cells. Regional commands were set up around the country, and an area like the Eastern Cape had over 50 cells. The High Command determined tactics and general targets, and was in charge of training and finance. Within the framework laid down by the High Command, the regional commands had authority to select local targets to be attacked. All MK members were forbidden to go armed into an operation and were not to endanger life in any way. One problem we encountered early on was the question of divided loyalties between MK and the ANC. Most of our recruits were ANC members who were active in the local branches, but we found that once they were working for MK, they stopped doing the local work they had been performing before. The secretary of the local branch would find that certain men were no longer attending meetings. He might approach one and say, "Men, why were you not at the meeting last night?" And the fellow would say, "Ah, well, I was at another meeting." "What kind of meeting?" the secretary would say. "Oh, I cannot say." "You cannot tell me? Your own secretary." But the secretary would soon discover the member's other loyalty. After some initial misunderstandings, we decided that if we recruited members from a branch, the secretary must be informed that one of his members was now with MK. One warm December afternoon, while I sat in the kitchen at Lily's Leaf Farm, I listened on the radio to the announcement that Chief Lutuli had been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize at a ceremony in Oslo. The government had issued him a 10-day visa to leave the country and accept the award. We all were, enormously pleased. It was, first of all, an acknowledgement of our struggle, and of the achievements of the chief as the leader of that struggle and as a man. It represented a recognition in the West that our struggle was a moral one, one too long ignored by the great powers. The award was an affront to the nationalists, whose propaganda portrayed Lutuli as a dangerous agitator at the head of a communist conspiracy. Afrikaners were dumbfounded. To them, the award was another example of the perversity of Western liberals and their bias against white South Africans. When the award was announced, the chief was in the third year of a 5-year ban restricting him to the district of Stanga in Natal. He was also unwell. His heart was strained and his memory was poor. But the award cheered him and all of us as well. The honor came at an awkward time, for it was juxtaposed against an announcement that seemed to call the award itself into question. The day after Lutuli returned from Oslo, MK dramatically announced its emergence. On the orders of the MK High Command, in the early morning hours of December 16th, the day white South Africans used to celebrate as Dingane's Day, homemade bombs were exploded at electric power stations and government offices in Johannesburg, Port Elizabeth, and Durban. One of our men, Petrus Molefe, was inadvertently killed, the first death of an MK soldier. Death in war is unfortunate, but unavoidable. Every man who joined MK knew that he might be called on to pay the ultimate sacrifice. At the time of the explosions, thousands of leaflets with the new MK manifesto were circulated all over the country, announcing the birth of Umkhonto Wesizwe. Units of Umkhonto Wesizwe today carried out planned attacks against government installations, particularly those connected with the policy of apartheid and race discrimination. Umkhonto Wesizwe is a new independent body formed by Africans. It includes in its ranks South Africans of all races. Umkhonto Wesizwe will carry on the struggle for freedom and democracy by new methods, which are necessary to complement the actions of the established National Liberation Movement. The time comes in the life of any nation when there remain only two choices, submit or fight. That time has now come to South Africa. We shall not submit, and we have no choice but to hit back by all means within our power in defense of our people, our future, and our freedom. We of Umkhonto have always sought, as the liberation movement has sought, to achieve liberation without bloodshed and civil clash. We hope, even at this late hour, that our first actions will awaken everyone to a realization of the disastrous situation to which the nationalist policy is leading. We hope that we will bring the government and its supporters to their senses before it is too late, so that both the government and its policies can be changed before matters reach the desperate stage of civil war. We chose December 16th, Dingane's Day, for a reason. On that day, white South Africans celebrate the defeat of the great Zulu leader Dingane at the Battle of Blood River in 1838. Dingane, the half-brother of Shaka, then ruled the most powerful African state that ever existed south of the Limpopo River. That day, the bullets of the Boers were too much for the assegais of the Zulu impis, and the water of the nearby river ran red with their blood. Afrikaners celebrate December 16th as the triumph of the Afrikaner over the African, and the demonstration that God was on their side, while Africans mourned this day of the massacre of their people. We chose December 16th to show that the African had only begun to fight, and that we had righteousness and dynamite on our side. The explosions took the government by surprise. They condemned the sabotage as heinous crimes, while at the same time deriding it as the work of foolish amateurs. The explosions also shocked white South Africans into the realization that they were sitting on top of a volcano. Black South Africans realized that the ANC was no longer an organization of passive resistance, but a powerful spear that would take the struggle to the heart of white power. We planned and executed another set of explosions 2 weeks later on New Year's Eve. The combined sound of bells tolling and sirens wailing seemed not just a cacophonous way to ring in the new year, but a sound that symbolized a new era in our freedom struggle. The announcement of Umkhonto spurred a vicious and unrelenting government counteroffensive on a scale that we had never before seen. The special branch of the police now made it their number one mission to capture members of MK, and they would spare no effort to do so. We had shown them we were not going to sit back any longer. They would show us that nothing would stop them from rooting out what they saw as the greatest threat to their own survival. Chapter 46. When Winnie visited, I had the illusion, however briefly, that the family was still intact. Her visits were becoming less frequent as the police were becoming more vigilant. Winnie would bring Zinzi and Zinani to Rivonia, but they were too young to know that I was in hiding. Magato, then 11, was old enough to know, and he had been instructed never to reveal my real name in front of anyone. I could tell that he was determined, in his own small way, to keep my identity a secret. But one day, toward the end of that year, he was at the farm playing with Nicholas Goldreich, Arthur's 11-year-old son. Winnie had brought me a copy of the magazine Drum, and Magato and Nicholas stumbled upon it while they were playing. They began paging through it when suddenly Magato stopped at a picture of me taken before I had gone underground. "That's my father," he exclaimed. Nicholas did not believe him, and his skepticism made Magato even keener to prove it was true. Magato then told his friend that my real name was Nelson Mandela. "No, your father's name is David," Nicholas replied. The boy then ran to his mother and asked her mother whether or not my name was David. She replied that yes, it was David. Nicholas then explained to his mother that Magato had told him that his father's real name was Nelson. This alarmed Hazel, and I soon learned of this lapse. Once again, I had the feeling that I had remained too long in one place. But I stayed put, for in a little over a week, I was to leave on a mission that would take me to places that I had only ever dreamed of. Now, the struggle would for the first time take me outside the borders of my country. In December, the ANC received an invitation from the Pan-African Freedom Movement for East, Central and Southern Africa, PAFMEXA, to attend its conference in Addis Ababa in February 1962. PAFMEXA, which later became the Organization of African Unity, aimed to draw together the independent states of Africa and promote the liberation movements on the continent. The conference would furnish important connections for the ANC and be the first and best chance for us to enlist support, money, and training for MK. The underground executive asked me to lead the ANC delegation to the conference. Although I was eager to see the rest of Africa and meet freedom fighters from my own continent, I was greatly concerned that I would be violating the promise I had made not to leave the country, but to operate from underground. My colleagues, including Chief Lutuli, insisted that I go, but were adamant that I return immediately afterward. I decided to make the trip. My mission in Africa was broader than simply attending the conference. I was to arrange political and economic support for our new military force, and more important, military training for our men in as many places on the continent as possible. I was also determined to boost our reputation in the rest of Africa, where we were still relatively unknown. The PAC had launched its own propaganda campaign, and I was delegated to make our case wherever possible. Before leaving, I secretly drove to Groutville to confer with the chief. Our meeting, at a safe house in town, was disconcerting. As I have related, the chief was present at the creation of MK and was as informed as any member of the National Executive Committee about its development. But the chief was not well, and his memory was not what it had once been. He chastised me for not consulting with him about the formation of MK. I attempted to remind the chief of the discussions that we had in Durban about taking up violence, but he did not recall them. This is in large part why the story has gained currency that Chief Lutuli was not informed about the creation of MK and was deeply opposed to the ANC taking up violence. Nothing could be further from the truth. I had spent the night before my departure with Winnie at the house of white friends in the northern suburbs, and she brought me a new suitcase that she had packed. She was anxious about my leaving the country, but once again remained stoic. She behaved as much like a soldier as a wife. The ANC had to arrange for me to travel to Dar es Salaam in Tanganyika. The flight to Addis Ababa would originate in Dar es Salaam. The plan was for Walter, Kathrada, and Duma Nokwe to meet me at a secret rendezvous in Soweto and bring me my credentials for the trip. It would also be a moment for last-minute consultations before I left the country. Ahmed Kathrada arrived at the appointed hour, but Walter and Duma were extremely late. I finally had to make alternative arrangements, and Kathy managed to locate someone to drive me to Bechuanaland, where I would charter a plane. I later learned that Walter and Duma had been arrested on their way. The drive to Bechuanaland was trying, as I was nervous both about the police and the fact that I had never crossed the boundaries of my country before. Our destination was Lobatse, near the South African border. We passed through the border without a problem and arrived in Lobatse in the late afternoon, where there was a telegram for me from Dar es Salaam, postponing my trip for a fortnight. I put up with my fellow treason trialist, Fish Keatsing, who had since moved to Lobatse. That afternoon, I met with Professor K.T. Motsite, the president of the Bechuanaland People's Party, which had been formed mainly by ex-ANC members. I now had unexpected spare time, which I used for reading, preparing my speech for the conference, and hiking the wild and beautiful hills above the town. Although I was not far outside my own country's borders, I felt as though I were in an exotic land. I was often accompanied by Max Mlonyeni, the son of a friend from the Transkei, and a young member of the PAC. It was as though we were on safari, for we encountered all manner of animals, including a battalion of sprightly baboons, which I followed for some time admiring their military-like organization and movements. I was soon joined by Joe Matthews, who had come from Basutoland, and I insisted we should make haste for Dar es Salaam. An ANC colleague in Lobatse had recently been kidnapped by the South African police, and I thought the sooner we could leave, the better. A plane was arranged, and our first destination was a town in northern Bechuanaland called Kasani, strategically situated near a point where the borders of four countries met: Bechuanaland, northern and southern Rhodesia, and southwest Africa, as these colonies were then known. The landing strip at Kasani was waterlogged, and we came in at a drier strip several miles away in the middle of the bush. The manager of a local hotel came to fetch us armed with rifles and reported that he had been delayed by a herd of rogue elephants. He was in an open van, and Joe and I sat in the back, and I watched a lioness lazily emerge from the bush. I felt far from my home streets of Johannesburg. I was in the Africa of myth and legend for the first time. Early the next morning, we left for Mbeya, a Tanganyikan town near the northern Rhodesian border. We flew near Victoria Falls and then headed north through a mountain range. While over the mountains, the pilot tried to contact Mbeya, but there was no answer. "Mbeya! Mbeya!" he kept saying into the microphone. The weather had changed, and the mountains were full of air pockets that made the plane bounce up and down like a cork on a rough sea. We were now flying through clouds and mist, and in desperation, the pilot descended and followed a twisting road through the mountains. By this time, the mist had become so thick we could not see the road, and when the pilot abruptly turned the plane, I realized that we narrowly missed a mountain that seemed to rear up out of nowhere. The emergency alarm went off, and I remember saying to myself, "That's the end of us." Even the ever-loquacious Joe was stone silent. But then, just as we could see no farther in the clouds, and I imagined we were about to crash into a mountain, we emerged from the bad weather into a gloriously clear sky. I have never enjoyed flying much, and while this was the most frightening episode I have ever had on a plane, I am sometimes adept at appearing brave, and I pretended that I was unconcerned. We booked in a local hotel and found a crowd of blacks and whites sitting on the veranda, making polite conversation. Never before had I been in a public place or hotel where there was no color bar. We were waiting for Mr. Markhangeli of the Tanganyika African National Union, a member of parliament, and unbeknown to us, he had already called looking for us. An African guest approached the white receptionist. "Madam, did a Mr. Mwakangele inquire after these two gentlemen?" he asked, pointing to us. "I'm sorry, sir," she replied. "He did, but I forgot to tell them." "Please be careful, madam," he said in a polite but firm tone. "These men are our guests, and we would like them to receive proper attention." I then truly realized that I was in a country ruled by Africans. For the first time in my life, I was a free man. Though I was a fugitive and wanted in my own land, I felt the burden of oppression lifting from my shoulders. Everywhere I went in Tanganyika, my skin color was automatically accepted rather than instantly reviled. I was being judged for the first time not by the color of my skin, but by the measure of my mind and character. Although I was often homesick during my travels, I nevertheless felt as though I were truly home for the first time. We arrived in Dar es Salaam the next day, and I met with Julius Nyerere, the newly independent country's first president. We talked at his house, which was not at all grand, and I recall that he drove himself in a simple car, a little Austin. This impressed me, for it suggested that he was a man of the people. Class, Nyerere always insisted, was alien to Africa, socialism indigenous. I reviewed our situation for him, ending with an appeal for help. He was a shrewd, soft-spoken man who was well-disposed to our mission. But his perception of the situation surprised and dismayed me. He suggested we postpone the armed struggle until Sobukwe came out of prison. This was the first of many occasions when I learned of the PAC's appeal in the rest of Africa. I described the weakness of the PAC and argued that a postponement would be a setback for the struggle as a whole. He suggested I seek the favor of Emperor Haile Selassie and promised to arrange an introduction. I was meant to meet Oliver in Dar, but because of my delay, he was unable to wait and left a message for me to follow him to Lagos, where he was to attend the Lagos Conference of Independent States. On the flight to Accra, I ran into Hemi Basna and his wife. Basna, who had once been my employer, had been offered a position in Accra. His radical politics and left-wing activities in South Africa had made him persona non grata there, and he was seeking political asylum in Ghana. The plane stopped in Khartoum, and we lined up to go through customs. Joe Matthews was first, then myself, followed by Basna and his wife. Because I did not have a passport, I carried with me a rudimentary document from Tanganyika that merely said, "This is Nelson Mandela, a citizen of the Republic of South Africa. He has permission to leave Tanganyika and return here." I handed this paper to the old Sudanese man behind the immigration counter, and he looked up with a smile and said, "My son, welcome to the Sudan." He then shook my hand and stamped my document. Basna was behind me and handed the old man the same type of document. The old man looked at it for a moment and then said in a rather agitated manner, "What is this? What is this piece of paper? It is not official." Basna calmly explained it was a document he had been given in Tanganyika because he did not have a passport. "Not have a passport?" the immigration official said with disdain. "How can you not have a passport? You are a white man." Basna replied that he was persecuted in his own country because he fought for the rights of blacks. The Sudanese looked skeptical. "But you are a white man." Joe looked at me and knew what I was thinking. He whispered to me not to intervene, as we were guests in the Sudan and did not want to offend our host's hospitality. But apart from being my employer, Basna was one of those whites who had truly taken risks on the behalf of black emancipation, and I could not desert him. Instead of leaving with Joe, I remained and stood close to the official, and every time Basna said something, I simply bowed and nodded to the official as if to verify what he was saying. The old man realized what I was doing, softened his manner, and finally stamped his document and said quietly, "Welcome to the Sudan." I had not seen Oliver in nearly 2 years, and when he met me at the airport in Accra, I barely recognized him. Once clean-shaven and conservatively groomed, he now had a beard and longish hair, and affected the military-style clothing characteristic of freedom fighters around the continent. He probably had exactly the same reaction to me. It was a happy reunion, and I complimented him on the tremendous work he had done abroad. He had already established ANC offices in Ghana, England, Egypt, and Tanganyika, and had made valuable contacts for us in many other countries. Everywhere I subsequently traveled, I discovered the positive impression Oliver had made on diplomats and statesmen. He was the best possible ambassador for the organization. The goal of the Lagos Conference of Independent States was to unite all African states, but it eventually disintegrated into bickering about which states to include or exclude. I kept a low profile and avoided the conference, for we did not want the South African government to know that I was abroad until I appeared at the PAFMEXA conference in Addis. On the plane from Accra to Addis, we found Gwa Hedebi, Peter Molatsi, and other members of the PAC, who were also on their way to PAFMEXA. They were all surprised to see me, and we immediately plunged into discussions concerning South Africa. The atmosphere was enjoyable and relaxed. Though I had been dismayed to learn of Gwa's leaving the ANC, that did not diminish my pleasure in seeing him. High above the ground and far from home, we had much more that united us than separated us. We put down briefly in Khartoum, where we changed to an Ethiopian Airways flight to Addis. Here I experienced a rather strange sensation. As I was boarding the plane, I saw that the pilot was black. I had never seen a black pilot before, and the instant I did, I had to quell my panic. How could a black man fly an airplane?